You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Today we're going plant-based. There's been a huge, real buzz around the vegan movement for the last few years, and this year's veganuary broke all-time records. Eco-conscious and ethical consumers are looking to eat more sustainably, and one man helping us to do that in the UK is Derek Sarno, co-founder of Wicked Healthy and executive chef and director of plant-based innovation at Tesco. Derek, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, Steph. Thank you for having me on, you guys. Appreciate it.
What did you have for breakfast today?
Coffee.
Coffee, and that's it.
That's pretty much what I have.
Clean and serene.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, sometimes I'm sitting by this computer so much with lockdown that I don't eat as well as I probably should be, and I probably shouldn't say that, but I do. You know, I drink coffee in the morning, and if I can, I'll get up and make some quick lunch or midday, you know, 11 o'clock or so.
Yeah. Now let's have I know that a lot of people have talked to you about the past. You've been on quite a journey to get to where you are today, but could you anyway just give us a brief tour of the highs and lows that you've experienced along the way?
The highs and I mean, how far do you want to go back?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really interested in the lows, you know.
Yeah, that's everybody is. I mean, briefly, like before I started, I used to work at Whole Foods Market as the global chef for the company there for 6 years. And I was pioneering like a lot of the plant-based stuff with my brother. We helped do their whole healthy eating initiative called Health Starts Here. And before that, you know, stepping even further back, I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist monastery and I was there for 3 years. And that's where I really started to hone how to cook more greens, grains, and beans, and just more healthier approach, more of the vegetarian, vegan style. Before that, I owned three different restaurants. Two of them were catering companies, really big at the time. Like we expanded all over New England and catered a lot of different things. And then I also had a farm. I did a 2-year stint where I emulated a farm. So I did a vegan organic farm with my brother, Chad. That's where I started getting into the growing and not needing animals for growing. So I'm totally jumping all over.
I like it.
And the reason why I went to the monastery was because my fiance, 3 years, she was killed in a car accident and it really threw me for a loop. Like it was
wow.
It was a horrible, horrible thing to happen. And I had to really get my head on straight. I couldn't work. I didn't understand what life was about. Before that, I was all selfish, all ego, all about just cooking food that tasted good, didn't care what was in it, didn't care how it came about. And that all changed when I went to the monastery and after Amanda had passed. So that's where the journey started. So that was 15 years ago. And this past 15 years has really shaped up I've shaped up so to really just drive a mission as far as helping to end animal suffering, because I don't believe that anything should suffer for us to enjoy an indulgent life.
Wow, that is quite an extraordinary journey, and I guess some spectacular lows to some extraordinary high times as well. So now you became director of plant-based innovation at Tesco. That is a very, very different company to Tesco, I would imagine. I mean, it's vast, it's very corporate. Why Tesco?
Well, Tesco is the largest in the UK, yeah? So the resources that they provide me to get this done is just beyond none. I don't know of any better retailer out there. And I've worked and studied a lot of them, but I really do appreciate the size and the way the organization is run. I have so much respect for the CEO team. That's pretty much why I'm here, for the resources and to really expand out and get the word out faster to the mainstream.
Mm. Now, I mean, some of the products that you produce in Tesco's are absolutely extraordinary. They're absolutely fantastic. But I wonder who needed who most, because Tesco really needed to shift. It needed to move on its feet. It needed to get a big foothold in the plant-based market. So yeah, who was the suitor in the combination, the relationship between you?
So when Tesco approached me, I had been taking a year off from Whole Foods. So I just had ended my career at Whole Foods and I went vegan the next day. And so that year off, during that year off, I learned photography. I raised two baby squirrels in my house. I learned how to bake sourdough bread.
The ninja squirrels.
Yeah, the ninja squirrels, exactly. Mm-hmm. I wrote the Wicked Healthy Cookbook with my brother Chad, and we started Good Catch Foods during that time. Also, Tesco had called, so they were looking for somebody to really inject a little bit of newness and innovation, and they were calling on me, and I said, look, I will come and cook and show you what I can do, but I don't want to cook animals anymore. So when they, Jason Terry had brought me over, and I met with the CEO team with Dave Lewis and a couple others, and we went around the stores. And I just, if you look around the stores, you know, if you just, it was only 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago, everything is just a sea of brown. So all the ready meals were just brown. All the sandwiches were just brown. There was no vibrant colors of like vegetables. So my whole mission was to just really drive something to eat for myself personally, because there was nothing vegan other than a falafel wrap, nothing colorful, nothing stood out on the shelf. Everything was an animal product. And that's, you know, what I did was I've just put together a proposal. They had asked, we had long conversations. It took a while. It took months and months. And then they just brought me over to get it done.
Mm. And were you in the US at the time?
I was in Portland, Oregon, which was, if you've ever been out there, it's probably some of the most amazing food and fertile soil. Mm. It's just amazing out
there. I've heard it's a fantastic place to be.
Yeah, I do love it out there.
Yeah. Now, veganism, let's have a quick think about veganism. Now, vegans have been around forever, but the vegan lifestyle is just picking up speed at the moment. Veganuary reported the biggest year ever this year. But it's been around as a sort of a relatively fringe concept. It almost feels like it's got the power, such an extraordinary power behind it that it's almost a fad, but I feel it's more than that. Why now? Why is the vegan lifestyle just taking over so powerfully now?
That's a great question. I'd have to attribute a lot of it to social media and just people really sharing ideas and what's going on. It really has expanded a lot of stuff, not just veganism, you know, but it's a good platform to really, anybody can show what they're doing, and you just have more access into it. You know, my brother has been vegan for a lifetime, as far as I'm concerned. And I used to make fun of him for it, you know, as a chef. until it's funny, people call it veganism. I just think it's more of a journey into compassion, into really, what are we doing? What are we doing to our food? What are we putting in our mouth? It's like, that's my whole big thing is it's, I don't necessarily want to be called a vegan. I just want to be known as a compassionate person and trying as hard as I can.
Yeah. But again, these issues, you know, the ecological issues have been around. We have been aware of them for decades, but it seems as though it just took so long for things to pick up speed. Do you think there has been a moment in time, or is it the growth of social media and the potential for people sharing ideas, which was outside the mainstream of the food industry discussions, which were dominated by the food industry, the big companies? And is it handing over the power to people to being able to chat about things themselves and giving them their own, you know, method of broadcast? Is that what shifted things?
Yeah, I mean, I feel so. As so, you know, if you remember growing, I don't know how old you are, Steph, but
very elderly.
If I remember growing up, I didn't have computers in high school, you know, so that we didn't have all this information where we have available now, as we did back then. Life seemed a little bit different than it does now. You know, I honestly don't know what the whole tipping point was, but I do attribute a lot of it to socials.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at what you're doing at Tesco, the plant-based range is a huge success there. What is your ultimate goal with it? What's next?
You know, just my ultimate mission, me and my brother and Wicked, is just to help end animal suffering. You know, if we can start with factory farms and really reducing that mass killing of animals to fit into the food system, then I'll consider my job done well. You know, I really want people to eat healthier, but healthier, I think, is everybody's individual choice, and they have to do it on their own, because, you know, you say health to one person, and they think it means something, and whereas it means something else to somebody else. It's just such a varied topic to go after. So it's not about health for me. It's just more about compassion in our food system and building. I would really love to see and help build a parallel food system. You know, if you look at animal agriculture, the way it's done now, I believe we can do it totally sustainable with a plant-based one, including mushrooms and vegetables being center of the plate and also plant-based alternatives.
You're listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Now, we've seen spectacular growth in sales of plant-based animal products, and the market is estimated to be worth $480 billion by 2024. But currently, fish and seafood product alternatives only make up around 1% of sales. So why is this? What are the challenges facing the seafood alternative industry? And how close are we to large-scale ramping up of production? To discuss the whole industry and its latest developments, we have Chris Kerr, founding partner, CIO, Unovis Partners, CIO, New Crop Capital, and executive chair of Gathered Foods.
Hello, everyone.
Chris, you're sort of serial investor and founder of companies in the alternative meats area. How do you see demand changing over the next 5 years? It must excite you.
I find it very exciting. I mean, we come in early as investors. We can come in early in you know, a company that goes from 0 to 5 million in revenues can still be a win from an investment standpoint. But did it have impact? Is it something that can make the world better? We invest in companies that ultimately will have a broad reach throughout society. And seafood is one of those proteins that is really everywhere. It's been part of human consumption for millennia. And it's one that is it's getting worse, particularly when you think about wild caught and some of the other problems that are inherent in the industry. So we look at this by splitting the fishing industry with the seafood industry. You know, the seafood industry is more of an experience. The fishing industry is more around, capturing, making proteins, gathering proteins. And so what we try to do is look at the opportunities in creating a good protein, but then how do we take that and push it into the broader market and all its various applications? And then seafood, it runs so broad that there's just almost an endless amount of applications that you can bring into the mix. It's not just did you invent tuna fish or tuna fish replacement is, but rather all the different ways that it can be used.
And then what about the other big issue around this is the messages. Now Chris, for meat alternatives, it's a classic triumvirate, isn't it? It's health, environment, and animal welfare. These are the reasons why people at the moment say that they will buy a meat alternative. But the health aspect of fish is already there. So are we just left with environment and animal welfare issues, or are there other aspects that are part of the message for the public?
Well, it's complex. Yes, health of fish have healthy oils, but is mercury healthy? No, it's not. If you can't separate the two, then do they neutralize each other, right? I think at the end of the day, you need to look at the entire experience and whether or not, you're doing your body good because you got some protein and good healthy oils. Is there something else that's problematic in there? And that goes all the way to the slave trade, all the way to environmental issues and bycatch and everything else that comes with it. So the real question is, for a very short-term culinary experience, how much damage are you willing to do, right? And that's a broader question for all humanity, but it's an important one. Ultimately, we're looking for a very simple culinary experience that only lasts a very short period of time. What are the implications of that? And if you start rippling that around the globe, they're pretty massive. And that's what we're dealing with today. We do want, the taste is really important. What we want is a good tasting experience, but it's not life-changing. We're not buying a Tesla or putting, solar panels on the roof of our house. We're trying to have a sandwich for lunch. And so the real question that we ask is, can we create a good culinary experience that gives the consumers what they want? They want a little bit of protein. They want a little bit of healthy oils, but mostly they just want a good tasting sandwich. I'll also add, we're held to a really high standard when it comes to creating really good tasting products. But the fact is, if you think about how you eat today, not that many people take a bite of a fish and that's all that's there. There's tartar sauce. There's all sorts of sauces that we use to mask that. We bread products. We do all sorts of things to make that experience better. So it isn't just, you know, how good is this single bite of raw fish? It's what else do we do to it? Not that many people take a Beyond Burger and stick it in their mouth raw. And so we want to ultimately look at the culinary experience. And if part of that culinary experience is healthy attributes, that's great. I think with seafood, the message has been look at these healthy oils and look at this protein. The fact is we can do that without involving a fish at all. And it really comes down to what's the culinary experience. Can we duplicate that? And that's our goal, is to duplicate the culinary experience. Not to give somebody seafood, but a culinary experience. We actually spent more time on creating mouthfeel because the flavor is nuanced and it's localized, right? So what you might want to eat in Germany is going to be, or Thailand is going to be different than in the UK or the United States. But the mouthfeel is going to be the same across the globe. Nobody has ever said, that's such a great fishy flavor. Nobody says that. What they want is that clean ocean kind of taste. And so the more fresh a fish is, the more it doesn't taste like fish, the more clean it is. And so what we wanted to do was focus on the core problem, which was break and mouthfeel and bite, and then to be able to layer in and dial up or dial down the flavor depending on what the market is, what the application is.
Today we're joined by Ria Rayberg, CEO of Veganuary. Welcome, Ria.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. Now, first of all, rather than talking about Veganuary, let's talk about you, because you joined Veganuary at a time when they were about to launch their international campaign. What's your background? How does your international experience in animal equality kind of inform Veganuary's own international strategy?
Sure. So before joining Veganuary, I was the co-executive director of Animal Equality Germany, which is the German branch of an international animal protection nonprofit. And I was also part of the leadership team of that organization. And you know, in the 6 years that I worked there, the organization grew from really a small grassroots movement with barely any funds at all into an international organization with chapters in several different countries. And that was a very interesting journey to witness and to learn from. And also my personal academic background is in intercultural communication. So I was very excited to have been chosen by the founders of Veganuary to come on board early in 2019 and lead on Veganuary's international expansion. And when I joined as part of sort of the strategy, we decided to take on board two additional flagship countries next to the UK, which was Germany and the US at the time for several different reasons. And then we also decided to extend our presence to several Latin American countries. So we started with Chile in 2019. And then this year we've added Argentina and Brazil as well. And we also started a campaign in South Africa, which is now being run by a partner organization. And we're also working with very committed partners in several other countries now. So we're running active partner campaigns in Switzerland, in Italy, Singapore, Sweden, France for the first time this year, India and Australia, and I hope I have them all. And sort of going back to your question, so one of my big learnings at Animal Equality was that when starting campaigns in other countries, really one size doesn't fit all, right? So what works in the UK doesn't necessarily work in India, it doesn't necessarily work in Germany. So it was really important for us to have local teams on the ground working on the campaign there and adapting the contents and really making sure that everything we do doesn't just fit sort of the language, but also the culture of the country or region we work in. So that's something that we've been implementing at Veganuary as well.
I can't believe that Argentina's an easy sell for you. I mean, that's so be focused on. Now, I thought that this might be an obvious question, but maybe it's not. Are you a vegan?
I am, yes. I've been a vegan for 10 years now, I think.
Very good. Because I was wondering, where I kind of thought, well, you must be a vegan. But then I thought, well, maybe somebody who isn't a vegan would be a good choice for Veganuary as well. Now, 2020, you had incredible success. Can you tell us about it? How did Veganuary change its approach to have such a huge penetration internationally and galvanize so many people from outside the UK?
Yeah, so when I joined, we really analyzed sort of the strengths and weaknesses that we saw at Veganuary. We had a pretty deep dive into which of our activities would have really the biggest possible impact for animals and for the well-being of our planet. And we saw that, you know, working with some of the biggest companies in the world was the tool that Veganuary, with its very popular non-judgmental approach, would probably almost uniquely be able be fit to use, right? And so we made a strategic plan, and we realized that the bigger we were able to make this movement, so really by inspiring hundreds of thousands of people to join and give a vegan diet a go, or what we do a lot as well is working with celebrities from all over the world, such as Joaquin Phoenix, who joined us last year, or Alicia Silverstone, or Paul McCartney, who really sort of help us spread the word about eating more plants, and by also creating fun marketing activations and billboards. So we had our first TV spot last year. We really realized that sort of the bigger the buzz and the media engagement, then the bigger the interest from companies to join the hype would be and, you know, market new and exciting vegan products. And that then, of course, would sort of multiply the positive impact on the world that a charity such as Veganuary, who's really quite small in comparison to many other charities, could ever have alone. So we had in 2019, for example, we had companies such as Pizza Hut add vegan menus with a link to our sign up page in all of their restaurants, or other companies literally spend millions of advertising budget on campaigns and stressing the benefits of a vegan diet and showing how delicious and affordable vegan eating can be. So we really see that this is where we see the biggest strength of this movement and where we can have the biggest impact on the world. And this year, actually, and this really blew my mind, because several companies have told us this year that Veganuary in the UK is now a bigger feature in the retail calendar than Christmas. And that's certainly something that we, you know, want to see in other countries as well. And hopefully we'll be able to internationalize our campaign a bit more.
And when you say that you're working with companies and that you're looking at the corporate sector, in practical terms, what does that mean?
Yeah, so it really depends a little bit from company to company. Just because there's so many, we had over 1,000 companies join last year, we're not really able to have very regular meetings with all of them. So what we did is we created what we call our business toolkit, which is really just an explanation of how can companies get involved in Veganuary, what are the benefits for them, what are the assets they can use, also explaining to them that it's for free to join, so we don't charge companies for participating in Veganuary, which many are surprised of to hear. And then we, you know, send that out, and once companies are interested in doing bigger activations or launching new vegan products and they want us to be more involved with, for example, coordinating marketing activations or thinking about sending out joint press releases or something like that, then we'll be more in touch and have sort of more communication throughout the year and planning the activations for the next January. Because that's a question we get a lot as well. It's like, what's the team doing the rest of the year? Just about
January. we do have after January, you just sleep for 11 months. Don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So is there a quantifiable benefit for companies to be associated with Veganuary?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, we're not naive, right? We know that this many companies aren't just joining because they think we're a great charity and they want to support us, but they're joining because they have understood that, you know, plant-based eating is the future, and more people are interested in seeing more innovation in the plant-based sphere and you know, switching their diets, be it one day a week or more days a week or 4 months or completely. So companies are joining because they know that more and more people are interested in this kind of food, and because they're seeing it in their sales as well. So we have so many companies showing us the figures after January, and usually their plant-based offering has increased. I don't know, KFC, for example, launched a vegan burger last year in the UK, and they sold 1 million of them just in January. So I think, yeah, we do see that it's it's a win-win when, you know, we're happy when companies are launching new vegan products and when they're marketing plant-based eating, but we see that really who's winning are the animals and the planet and people that are eating more healthier vegan options.
Yeah. Is that a difficult combination of factors, the sort of the moral issue and the business issue, or do you think they're just inextricably linked in terms of your targets? I'm interested in the sort of the difference between a moral imperative, i.e. Animal welfare and not mm-hmm. having to kill animals in order to eat, but then businesses actually joining for a financial imperative rather than a moral one. And I wondered, is it annoying for you that these two things kind of have to be juggled, or is that just the way that it's going to work?
Yeah, I think that's just the way a little bit the world works, right? I wish everyone was, you know, going vegan for the animals, but that's just not the way it's going to be. People are people, and we care about, you know, what's the cheap option, and more people start caring about their health as well, and more people start caring about the environment, but not everyone is going to be an activist. So I think we're quite realistic and pragmatic in that sense and saying, we don't really care why people want to choose plant-based or why companies want to join in and bring more plant-based meals or menus to the market. We care if less animals are being hurt and if we all have a planet that is more habitable for all of us and for next generations to come as well.
Your bottom line isn't a cash one. It's a moral one of fewer animals dying, I guess. Now, what countries did you see the greatest success in this year?
In terms of working with businesses, I would say obviously after the UK, we saw the biggest engagement in Germany, which was quite interesting. And we did choose Germany originally as one of our flagship countries because we felt it was one of the next countries that had kind of this tipping point, a moment where, you know, there was so much talk about veganism and it was becoming a little bit more mainstream and a little bit more just out there, but kind of this movement was missing that would help bring it all together, the people, the celebrities, the organizations, the companies that could sort of all at one moment in time just make veganism the trending topic of the month. Mm-hmm. So we've really seen that worked really well in Germany last year. And then in terms of really people signing up and receiving our resources and trying plant-based, we see huge interest in Latin America, which is great. And then in the US, we've seen great interest too, I think, especially in terms of media coverage. So last year we had articles in the New York Times or Wall Street Journal or Washington Post. So we really see that there's sort of more interest also that like trickles over to the mainstream. Yeah. But one thing that's really, really interesting in the US is that there seems to be some resistance to the term vegan. And that, of course, is something that as veganer, we were not really able to get rid of. So we do see that there's more resistance from companies to join the campaign just because we have that word in our name.
Really? What, tell me more. What is the negative association? Why is it bad? Is that another kind of right-wing issue of don't cramp my freedoms?
I don't know. I think it just has a more sort of negative radical connotation, maybe more of an activist-y connotation. So in terms of companies wanting to join, they would always market their products as plant-based. And we obviously were not called plant-based January, but veganuary. Yeah. So for whatever reason, there's a fear there of actually using this term.
How extraordinary. Okay. Now, what are the main reasons that people take part in veganuary? Have these reasons shifted over time?
Yeah, they actually have. So we had the number one reason was always animals. So basically for many people that signed up with us, trying veganism was about ending their role in animal suffering. But then last year, for the first time, health actually overtook that reason. So I think 1% more, so 38% of the people that signed up with us gave health as the main reason. And over 50% of the people that we surveyed afterwards actually said that their health improved. So they saw something positive about their health after the months of eating vegan. So I think they signed up with an expectation. For most, it was met, luckily. And then the reason number three is the environment. And that's something we've seen sort of climbing up year on year now. And of course, we know that animal farming is one of the leading emitters of climate changing gases and obviously contributes to the climate crisis. And this is just something that through the media and activism, I think is just much more in people's minds now. And they're realizing that, you know, by eating plant-based just for months, that they can already do something sort of in their own small world, so to say, to make a difference there. And people are choosing it as a form of activism.
Yeah. And is there, I mean, do you have any numbers on the potential impact that this has had on the amount of meat eaten and quantifiable health benefits, environmental change?
Yeah, so we actually just hit a very exciting Veganuary milestone, which was our 1 millionth participant since we were founded signed up. And we sort of took that as an opportunity to ask Dr. Helen Harvard from Harvard University to sort of look into the impact for us that these 1 million past participants had by eating vegan for 31 days. And she found that over 103,000 tons of CO2 equivalent was saved. And that's sort of to put that more into something that we can imagine or really kind of see more visually. That's equivalent to driving around the world almost 15,000 times with a UK car. So I think that's quite significant. And then she also found that over 6 million liters of water were saved. So that's the same as flushing the toilet almost 500,000 times. And there's a calculator from the Vegan Society, and they sort of calculated that these 1 million participants also spared the lives of 3.4 million animals on factory farms. So we think that's really exciting to just kind of show that if many people do something relatively small together, collectively, it can have quite the impact. And this is all these numbers are just for this 1 month. So we know that a lot of people actually stick to a vegan diet after having tried it for months, and that's not included in these numbers. Yeah. And then we also know that a lot more people do Veganuary than actually sign up on our website. So Kantar, I think in 2019, the Research Institute, they estimated that about 10 times as many people in the UK do Veganuary than actually sign up on our website.
I'm the same. I haven't signed up, but I do it pretty regularly. Thank you so much for joining us, Rhea. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you heard from Rhea Rehberg, CEO of Veganuary, and me, Stefan Gates. Thank you, Rhea. Have a brilliant day.
Thank you so much. You too.
And if you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.